What's that? Couple orders. I put them up on your desk, though. Nothing very impressive. What's that? Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, of course, ordinarily, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2- 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because, well, we're hoping to have with us in a few minutes Steve Sawyer from Noah's Pantry. And we're going to be talking about making preparations for what's going on. And Steve is helping us here keep these programs on the air. Coming to you, and, you know, certainly we are facing many, many unusual problems at the present time. Never before in my lifetime do I remember that having as many hurricanes and devastating hurricanes as we've had recently. In fact, it is said that the Hurricane Wilma, which apparently is not going to hit at least the coastline of America, it's going to going through the Keys and may have some impact on Florida, seems to be moving certainly towards Mexico, the Yucatan Peninsula, but it could change its direction at any time, under any circumstances. We seem to be seeing more and more very, very ferocious hurricanes. Why is that? Well, then, of course, we have other things that are going on. We hear a lot about the danger of the bird flu. And you know, we hear that certainly this epidemic is killing birds all throughout the Orient, and now it's into Moscow, it's into Romania, it's into Turkey. We've never had anything quite like this before. Now, a lot of the birds, of course, are not affected, and other birds, of course, do become effective. It's suggested that they have killed about 150 million birds trying to stop the spread of this disease, and some of the countries are acting very responsibly. Others are not. The question is, oh, could this ever get to the point where it could spread into human beings? I will tell you that I have not seen in quite some time major media, as effective as they are in frightening the American people. Certainly there was the subject of the ozone hole. Do you remember when we used to hear about the ozone hole all the time? Oh, the ozone hole, and people are going to get cancer, and there are going to be all sorts of complications from people getting cancer, and day in and day out we heard about that. We heard about how all the sheep are dying down in Patagonia because of the in Tierra del Fuego, and people were getting skin cancers down there. Of course, if you know anything about Tierra del Fuego, nobody's out there sunbathing in that area. In fact, my good friend who'd written extensively on DDT, Dr. Edwards, actually went down to Tierra del Fuego and talked to the people there, you know, about all these reports about the terrible damage the ozone hole was doing to the sheep, and all the sunbathers were getting skin cancers, and it was all made up. But then as soon as they, of course, got Freon outlawed, and that's what it was really all about, it was all about Freon and getting that outlawed so that DuPont could get could it get another product into the marketplace. Why? Because, see, with the patent off on Freon, it would be very, very cheap. And this was the most carefully calculated scam I certainly have ever seen and never heard of, and it was designed for one and only one purpose, and that was, of course, to outlaw Freon. And once Freon was outlawed, then, of course, suddenly there's no more ozone hole. Almost miraculously, the ozone hole is gone. And we're seeing the same thing today with global warming, the fact that the world is warming up, and of course it's warming up. It's been warming up since 1600, and we'll be back in just a minute to tell you more about these scams that they're using, but is there a purpose behind them? Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we seem to be having difficulty getting our regular scheduled guest, so I'm going to ask if my producer will go ahead and get the guest that we have scheduled for the second half hour, and we'll try to get Steve on some other time. But the point I was really trying to make was that you can tell when all of the media, ABC, CBS, NBC, U.S. News, Time, Newsweek, they're all carrying the same stories, focusing our attention on the same issues, and certainly one of those issues is the issue and the potential danger that we see from the Well, we're having a little problem getting our guest here, so I'm going to see if we can get Melody on a little earlier than we'd anticipated. Under many circumstances, you see how they're focusing our attention on the danger of avian flu. Now, I do not know whether this is being done because they are going to release avian flu, because you know they have the ability to engineer these diseases. Maybe they're just trying to scare us to death. Maybe they're going to try to frighten us to the point where we're willing to accept military control of our nation. Or maybe it has to do, as it did with the ozone hole, which was really a scam for DuPont so that they could make a lot of money on the new refrigerant that they had to offer. Maybe this is all about Tamiflu, you know. There's only one treatment for this terrible disease that could kill hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people here. And, of course, that is Tamiflu. And who do you think is going to make all the money off of that? Well, as you know, the product is made by Roche, but it was developed by a company named Gilead. And who do you think was the CEO of Gilead up until 2001? Why, his name was Donald Rumsfeld, the same man who gave us NutraSweet, which has created all sorts of cancers and disease and devastated the lives of so many people. And so here, Donald Rumsfeld was the head of Gilead that developed Tamiflu, that licensed it to Roche, and now suddenly, with a coordinated effort all across America, indeed all across the world, we're told of the danger of avian flu. Is it a danger? Quite frankly, I don't know. I don't think so. On the other hand, I do know that Dr. MacArthur testified before the House Appropriations Committee in July of 1969 and talked about the fact he wanted $10 million to create a new disease for which there'd be no immune response. And they wanted $10 million, and then said, some people think we shouldn't do it because it's another method of mass killing, but we want the money to develop that new disease, and I believe they did. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we've just been talking a little bit about the strange things that are going on in the world today. We're seeing hurricanes like we've never seen before. The attention of the American people is being focused on the danger of avian flu, and as I was just saying, I do not believe that it is simply by coincidence that there's only one treatment for this avian flu, and that is something called Tamiflu. It's a very, very expensive product. Ordinarily, if you get 10 pills, it'll cost you $60 to $80. And, of course, we really don't even know it's going to be effective, but many of the countries are stocking up on this. They're talking about spending $3 billion here in the United States to buy Tamiflu so that it'll be available for everybody when the epidemic strikes. And I was simply pointing out that the product is manufactured by Roche, which is a Swiss company, but it was actually licensed to Roche by a company known as Gilead. And then we simply ask the question, who was the president of Gilead? And, of course, up until 2001, it was a man named Donald Rumsfeld. So we know Donald Rumsfeld, of course, put pressure on our government to actually allow NutraSweet, which is a product that's made up of methanol and aspartic acid and phenylalanine. And methanol blinds you, aspartic acid is an excitotoxin that destroys your brain, and phenylalanine, and of course, some people have a sensitivity to that, and you can get all sorts of complications from phenylalanine. And under many circumstances, aspartame has been associated with so many terrible conditions, including brain tumor, pathological obesity, infertility, male infertility, female infertility, endocrine disruption. And yet, of course, it was Donald Rumsfeld who used political pressure to get that product legalized through the FDA, even though FDA officials had fought and objected to putting that on the market for almost 15 years. Donald Rumsfeld got it on the market and made millions and millions of dollars for himself. And now, isn't it just by coincidence that the product put out by the company he was the CEO of is the only treatment we have available for the avian flu, which is going to kill hundreds of billions, if not billions, of people, if you believe what we're being told? Well, I believe we're being frightened to death, and I'm not saying that the epidemic is not going to come, But I don't know why they're just spending so much time and effort through the media to draw attention to an epidemic which shows no evidence so far that it is going to mutate and infect human beings. So, and we find certainly a great deal of concern here on the West Coast about the dangers of earthquakes. And there's so much to frighten us to death. Certainly we're facing very real problems as far as our economy is concerned. The economy has begun to turn down. And I really feel that we are living in very, very uncertain times. And, of course, that was why we were going to be talking with Steve Sawyer about preparation during this hour. But, well, Steve is unavailable, so we are going to be talking, hopefully, very soon to Melody Cedarstorm. And Melody is going to be joining us and helping, too, to keep Radio Liberty on the air. Hopefully we'll have Melody with us just in a few minutes. But as you're watching the economy, it's really very, very interesting. The dollar is going up, and yet you would expect with all the problems we're having and the growing deficits, both domestic and international, as far as our trade deficit is concerned, that the dollar would be going down. It's going just the opposite from what you might anticipate. But even more unusual and truly paradoxical is ordinarily when the dollar goes up in value, why the value of gold and silver turns down. And though unusually here in the last month or so, last about 3 weeks, why the dollar and silver have actually been raising. They've backed off a little bit, but they've hit new highs here just within the about a week and a half ago. So with that as the background, Melody, thank you very much for coming on to the program early today.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's great to be here.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about you? People have never heard of you before.
Well, my name is Melody, and I'm with Discount Gold and Silver Trading, and we're going into our 12th corporate year at Discount Gold and Silver Trading. And I'm just not used to talking about myself, Dr. Stan.
All right, that's all right. You don't have to. I don't want to embarrass you. Anyway, Melody comes with a very, very good recommendation.
Yes, I do.
Norm, and who followed
I'm
her
not
career.
Like, I'm not like most guys out there, Dr. Stan.
Oh, you mean you don't like to talk about yourself? All right, fine. Well, anyway, what's your take on what's happening economically? Because certainly these are very unusual times. Even Alan Greenspan says we've never had a time like this before.
No, we haven't. And everything is so out of balance. And, I mean, you were talking about the dollar. The dollar doesn't seem to know, you know, if it wants to go up, go down. Same way with gold, silver. Everything was very volatile. And, you know, they're micromanaging this economy every second of every day. You know, so as soon as you have a little mishap economy, they go there and fix it. And the way they fix it is by flooding whatever needs to be fixed with lots of fiat currency. And they can only do that for so long, because every time they continually add money to the economy, prices continue to go up. And we're seeing that with the inflation. Even with Hurricane Katrina, we haven't seen anything yet as far as the amount of funds that they're going to be placing for the rebuilding of that area for Katrina and Rita, and we don't know about Wilma. So that all equals to higher inflation.
And I think what people have to understand is where money comes from. You know, at one time we had money that was tied to something. It was tied to gold, and it was like a ship in a storm, and you always want to get an anchor down so that the ship won't drift onto shore. And gold was the anchor that was the basis of our financial system. But we've turned away from the old traditions. We've gone into something called fiat money, which is the government prints money and creates tremendous prosperity. But in so doing, why the dollar continues losing its value. And certainly the dollar of today is worth about a penny of what a dollar was worth, you know, 100 years ago. So we've just gradually destroyed the value of money. And in so doing, wiped out the value of people's savings, of their annuities, their CDs, their bank accounts. And anybody put their money in the bank 100 years ago, and they've been getting interest on it all this time, that money has become essentially worthless. And this has happened time and time again down through the ages. Well, ordinarily what happens then, about every 20 years or so, why the central bank then contracts the economy, slows down the what's going on, and then, of course, lets the economy bottom out for a time, and then builds again. And had that been done effectively, you know, probably half a dozen years ago, why, we wouldn't be in the mess we are today. This is what they did in 1980, and they just ground the economy to this, to a stop, by raising the interest rates up to 18%. And actually, we had, we had inflation about 18%. They got interest rates up over 20%. But if they were to do that now, they would entirely collapse the economy. And so Alan Greenspan has said, we have never been in this sort of a situation before. And when you're facing an uncertain economic times, it's then that people in our country and other countries throughout the world beginning to look for some means of securing the value of their lifelong work. We do know that over in India and in China and in many areas in the, certainly in the Far East, people are turning to gold and silver as they always have in uncertain times. Do you find the same thing happening here in the United States more so than, say, a year or two ago?
Well, there's more questions, there's more curiosity, but I think we're a long cry from to where the public out there really begins to purchase gold. I think you'll see gold around 800 or more before the public out there picks up steam, and so I don't think we're quite there yet. They're still in their little world that everything is fine. They're totally brainwashed, and they don't want to hear, because, you know, if people have to agree and if they have to think about the information that you just relayed, that means they have to make changes. And most people, they don't like change. And so, you know, they're very reluctant to listen to what's really going on. But it's coming gradually. It will come. And when they open their eyes and they start opening their pocketbooks to purchasing gold, we'll see gold, as many economists out there predict, gold 1,500 and higher, 3,000, 3,500, and I've even heard higher prices for gold when you take into consideration the amount of debt. We're talking trillions and trillions of dollars of debt. Gold could go anywhere. So I think that's coming very soon. So now is the key. Now is the time to purchase your gold while it's still low. I mean, everybody forgets that you're supposed to buy low and sell high.
Well, I usually find myself buying high and then selling low. But you know, the thing is that certainly I've been around long enough and I've seen these cycles happen again and again. The people in the Orient, the people in India, the people in China really have a much different look and view of the world. They don't like living on debt. Here in America, we live on debt. You keep borrowing, and you've got a credit card, and you can keep money by simply buying things with your credit card. That actually creates the money. You can write a check, and all of these things are artificially creating money. And the only trouble is you have to pay it back, but we haven't had to worry too much about that in the past. You could always go bankrupt. The worst thing that could happen. The only thing is that is about to change.
Sure,
we need to see the people who control our economy know that there's going to be some terrible, terrible things happening, and that's why they passed a new bankruptcy law. And if you haven't gone bankrupt yet, it may be almost too late to do it. Because if you don't go bankrupt by the end of this month and wipe out your debt, why, you may very well be in a position of indentured servitude. If you bought a house that you can't afford, you think you're going to walk away from it? I got news for you. And that debt will be with you the rest of your life. And we've created a situation where many people are going to be in indentured servitude for the rest of their life. We're going to be back in just a few minutes with Melody. Well, Melody, what do you think about this new bankruptcy law? Have you contemplated at all the significance of why, at this time in history, as never before, to my knowledge, at least not during my lifetime, they suddenly wanted to change the bankruptcy law? Is it possible that the people who run things behind the scenes know something that the rest of the people don't know?
Well, gee, Stan, what do you think? Of course, absolutely, that's why they passed these laws, and who knows what other laws could come about because of the situation in which we are in. And that's why I encourage everyone, please, take control of your finances. Don't become trapped. Get out of debt. Pay off those credit cards. You don't need them. Put them, once they're paid off, put them away. Lock them up or throw them away. And you don't need them. Get your finances in order and protect yourself, because gold will be the only thing that will protect you from the hyperinflation in which we will eventually see. And just like, you know, the examples, I'm sure most everyone has heard, you know, in Germany in the early 20s with the hyperinflation, gold was there to protect you, and it will again. It's not so far, you know, you talked earlier about the Orient and the foreign countries. It really wasn't that long ago that gold was a world currency. And that's why these foreign countries realize the importance of gold. It's only our country, the Americans in this country, the people here, don't understand. They don't understand the value. And they're going to wake up one day and everything that they thought was precious is going to be gone.
And I really think that's really what's such a tragedy, is because people who do not understand the history of money, they don't understand what money is, why they can be wiped out so easily, and to have worked your whole life, you know, to thinking you're going to have security when you get to the point when you get older and you're ready to retire, and suddenly find that gone. People are finding, so many people have had the pension funds, and they thought those pension funds were going to be there for them, and now the people who work for Delphi and for General Motors and for the airlines and so many other countries companies are beginning to find out that those pension funds are not going to be there for them. And even if they do get 30 or 40 or 50 cents on the dollar may not be worth very much. Unless you really understand what's going on economically, I think that you are laying yourself open and your family open to terrible, difficult times. And I really believe, having been watching things now for well over 50 years and having seen these cycles go up and down and studied the history of the past, that gold and silver and precious metals and material things are the things you must be in at this period of time. And certainly you don't want to be buying property, because property is way, way, way overpriced. In fact, everybody is beginning to admit that the property bubble, the housing bubble, is about to burst. And certainly Alan Greenspan has talked about these things. People need to begin reading Alan Greenspan, begin trying to understand what he's really saying, because he uses long, convoluted sentences, and what you have to do is have a yellow pen, and you underline what he says in the first part of the sentence and then the last part of the sentence, and ignore what he says in the middle, because he puts that in there to confuse you. But if you listen to him very closely, he is telling you that the increase in the price of oil is going to begin taking money out of the economy. The economy is going to begin to contract, and of course, whether they're going to flood the money economy with money or let the deflation take place, I think they're going to be allow this thing to go into an inflationary spiral, and at that point the value of everything could be destroyed. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with Melody's Cedar Storm, and Melody is in the gold and silver market, and she's certainly is kind enough to come on with us and talk with us this evening about her view on what's going on. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But what are your thoughts about the fact that, you know, we're seeing such a marked increase in the price of gasoline? And we're talking about an increase of somewhere between 40 and 70% increase in the price of natural gas, and at least 40 to 50% increase in the price of heating oil in the east here in California, where most of our houses are heated with natural gas. And, of course, the price is really going to go up here. The price of electricity is going to be going up. What's the impact of this on, you know, on our economy?
It's going to have a major impact. I'm in central Pennsylvania. And so far, we've had a fairly warm October, and I can only say hopefully it will follow through into winter, and perhaps we'll have a milder winter than what I have heard some predictions. It's going to hurt a lot. Heating bills are to rise 50%, And when you have a consumer out there, we have an economy that's based on spending. And when you have consumers who can't spend anymore because they're paying high heating oil, high heating bills, they're paying higher gasoline bills, their credit card rates will be rising. You know, you talk about the bankruptcy laws and so forth. That's also built in, and they're changing every day. These credit cards can increase the interest rates on cards and their late payments and everything. These people are strapped. They've gone out. They bought everything that they could put their hands on, and they're living in homes that they can't afford. And so it will have a major impact on their purchasing power.
And I really agree with you, Melody. Of course, the interesting thing that nobody is pointing out is there is no need for heating oil prices to go up because there is a strategic supply of heating oil. It was put aside and invested in by Congress. So if we ever did get into a bind like we are today, where supposedly there is a shortage of oil, why we could use that the government's strategic supply of heating oil to bring the price down. But the president refuses to do that. And what does that tell me? That tells me that the people who are telling the president what to do don't want the price of heating oil to come down. We have over 700 million barrels of oil stored away in the strategic oil reserve. And that could be used to bring down the price of gasoline. But the president, although he's released a little of that, it hasn't had that much of an impact. We could bring the price right on down to, you know, $1.50 a gallon for gasoline if the president wanted to. But the people who tell the president what to do are not telling him to bring the prices down. So this tells me that what they want is keep the prices up, to slow down the economy, to slow down the purchasing, and, of course, in the process, an awful lot of people are going to have problems. Well, let's go to Ed who's calling here. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Brief question. I'll take the answer on the radio. Last week, Melody, do you recall, right at the end of the program, you were cut off due to time, lack of time, and you were talking about the FDR when gold, he made it illegal, but they kept theirs with a 15%, was it, premium as to being collectibles. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
That was that loophole that they had. Could you reiterate that or explain? You didn't have time last week.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mel. Sure, I'd be happy.
And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. What was he specifically talking about there?
Well, in 1984, the U.S. Treasury further defined what a gold or silver collectible coin was by introducing an IRS regulation defining numismatic coins as collective coins from which the gross proceeds from a sale exceed more than a minimum 15% of the underlying precious metal content. So the coin has to be rare and unusual. And that simply means that a rare coin, a collectible coin, a numismatic coin, must have a collector premium of 15% more than its gold or silver content to qualify as a numismatic coin and not a bullion coin. So there's a lot of misrepresentation out there when people look at Swiss francs. They're a bullion coin. They're dated prior to 1933, but they don't sell back at more than 15% of the gold content. It sells back at melt value and sometimes below melt value. So therefore, it does not have that criteria that in 1984 they had defined.
No, but this is 1984 they defined it that?
They defined that in 1984, the U.S. Treasury and the IRS.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment or two with the Melody. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, one of the things with gold coins, and I'm not much of an expert on those things, but I know you are, there are a lot of coins out there that they will tell you that they come from Europe, and you know, there are not that very many of them around, and some of these they really charge quite a bit for, sometimes a premium of 30 or 40%, but there are a lot of coins that nobody's ever heard of before. What do you think of those?
Or the coins that no one's ever heard of before.
Right. like maybe a Dutch guilder or something like that.
No, I know. They're all foreign gold. And you know what? If you buy any coin, buy for the truth of the coin. Buy for what it is. You know, there's a lot of misrepresentation of turning a bullion coin into a numismatic coin or a collectible coin because it's dated prior to 1933. Foreign coins is not my first choice when I'm putting together a portfolio. I believe people have choices now. There's all kinds of coins that you can purchase. And when gold starts to rise and the public out there begins to buy, product will disappear. I believe bullion coins, foreign gold, are coins that you buy when there's nothing else to buy. Or let's say you already have a large gold holding or portfolio of precious metals. And you just want to speculate a little more, and you just want to add a different coin to your portfolio. Well, that's okay. You know, foreign coins are fine. But stick with what's readily recognizable here in this country. And I always base my customers' portfolios on their investment objectives, not mine. I don't believe one coin fits all. We all have views. Pardon?
Go ahead.
We all have views. We all have, I have customers who want to be protected against confiscation. I have customers who just want bullion. So it's not me putting together my clients' portfolios. We do it together. I educate them, and then we come together and make a decision on what would best fit their needs. And we stretch their dollars the furthest. We try to get as much gold as possible for their money, whether it's numismatic coins, whether it's bullion coins, silver. We've always done that. We build relationships with our customers. Our customers come back to discount gold and silver trading because they know they've been treated fairly. They've received a great price, great advice, truth, honesty, and we've been doing it for over 12 years. We have customers, we have so many referrals. I mean, I learned a long time ago. I spent 15 years in the insurance.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Melody was just saying that her view is that everybody is different, that certain people want the gold bullion coins, other people want collectibles, other people want a guarantee against confiscation, although I don't know how we would ever get a guarantee, because they can always change the laws. Certainly it sounds like you're suggesting that some people would be diversified in what they were doing. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, Dr. Stan, in 1933, why did they exempt collectibles at that point in time? Because they owned them. And they'll do it again. They'll make gold illegal to own, because I do believe there'll be a one-world currency, and they'll make it illegal to own. But do you think that the elitists who own coin collections are going to turn them in? No, they're not going to give it back.
No, of course, always have a different...
There's a loophole there for a reason. There's a reason why gold is the most gold is the only non-regulated investment out there. Numismatic coins, you can buy and sell $1 million of them, and I don't have to do any forms whatsoever. I don't have to do any 1099s. Even after 9/11 and the Patriot Act, why is gold still not regulated? Because they own it. That's why. They make the laws.
Amen. I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, I always like to go back to that article that Alan Greenspan had written back in 1965.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, he at that time began. He wrote about the importance of gold. And he basically said, in the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect saving from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. The financial policy of the welfare state requires there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare state's tirade against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. And ladies and gentlemen, we've never had more deficit spending than we have right now. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling. And again, if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Roger, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, thank you. And Melody, if you could please point out any flaw in my reasoning here, and I expect as a dealer you might not be in a position to advocate this, but given that the kleptocracy, our government could change its mind just as it did in the 30s gold grab, can it not also change its mind for numismatics and non-numismatics alike to reassert universal confiscability? And therefore, wouldn't the safest thing to be to, say, purchase through an intermediary, say, an older friend with a foot in the grave, who'd be only happy, say, knowing what's up to help you out?
Certainly, Melody, do you understand Roger's concern? He's saying, well, how do you know they're not going to change those rules? Would you be better to buy things through an intermediary?
We don't know they're not. We don't know. We don't know anything. They can do anything. But because we don't know what they're going to do, wouldn't you want to protect yourself?
And I think that's right, Roger. What you're going to have to do, first of all, is make all of your arrangements, diversify, understand the history of money, and then you're going to have to put your faith in the Lord, because we are to do the best we can to look after ourselves and our family. But in the final analysis, if things go as we fear they're going to go, we may have to rely upon our Lord. But in the meantime, I think he expects us to be intelligent and to use our knowledge to try it, as people have down through the ages, to survive in difficult times. Anything else you want to ask, Roger?
God bless.
God night. Good night. All right, again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And, you know, it's really very interesting as you watch the stock market, and I think most people honestly believe that the stock market reflects the attitudes of the American people, you know, and as this market goes up or down, either up with exuberance and anticipation and confidence, or down with disillusionment and fear. But I think we have another issue that's come in, and that is something called the plunge protection team, which, of course, is authorized by the government to prevent fear or panic in the stock market. And they actually create money out of nothing, the Federal Reserve working in concert with certain of the major brokers and certain of the major banks, actually rig the stock market, at least on many issues, to actually control our perception. When the market is going up, we feel good. When the market is going down, we feel bad. And it's interesting that they've actually allowed the market to sag here over the last week to 10 days, almost as if they might be preparing us for the difficult times that lie ahead. What are your thoughts on that, Melody?
I think so, too. And you're right about one thing. The Dow 10,000 is very symbolic. I believe, you know, you could ask anybody in this country what the Dow is, and, you know, they'll know what it is. You can have a nuclear blast go off in New York, and the first thing they'd want to know is what the Dow is doing. So, and so I believe the plunge protection team goal is to keep the Dow above 10,000, because that remains, it keeps people calm, it eliminates any type of panic, and so that is their goal, and they will do what they need to do to when they're ready. You know, you got to realize that the elitists, they get their money to promote their agenda through Wall Street. So they need those funds there. They need your money there. And they're not going to let it fall until they're ready. Now, yes, a catalyst could come from left field, and many of us thought that, you know, maybe Katrina was that catalyst, and we still haven't seen the final effects of the hurricanes this year in the past month. So that still could be. And so you're right. They're going to drag it out as long as they can, but, you know, when they're ready, they'll let it go.
And I really feel you're right. Well, let's get your telephone number out and certainly your website. And do you have anything that you send people out if they give you a call and some sort of a knowledge about what you're doing?
Yes, we have an introductory package that we would be more than happy to send out. We don't do glossy brochures. We send out a little information about discount gold and silver trading, a little bit of our thoughts and our views. And if you would like that, you can call 1-800-375-4188. I do have someone standing by to answer the telephones. That's 1-800-375-4188. If you'd like to go to the website, that is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. And the and is spelled out, discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. And for those of you with email, if you'd like to email me a question, you can either do so from the website or discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com.
Well, I really think that we have to watch what people are a lot smarter than I am and you know, are doing, and certainly Warren Buffett is shorting the dollar. He's invested over $20 million overseas just to short the dollar. He lost over $300 million of Berkshire Hathaway money last year. Shorting the dollar, of course, these are leveraged positions, and he just chalked that up to loss, and he's maintained that position because he's very pessimistic on the dollar, as is Bill Gates, as is George Soros, as are these people of great wealth. And if they're concerned, I think we should be concerned as well. And the thing that really bothers me is so many people are out there living as if the good times are going to go on forever. It's sort of like the people on the Titanic who had no idea of what lay ahead. And I really, one reason I do what I do is at least try to warn people that they want to make all sorts of preparations, physical preparations, financial preparations, spiritual preparations for what I think are the very difficult times that are coming. Our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question or a comment for our special guest this evening, and that's Melody Cedarstorm. Is it Storm or Strom?
Well, I shall. I didn't want to correct. It's Strom.
Cedarstrom. Okay, fine. So, okay, well, that's all right. That's been one of my shortcomings, is always in phonics. And, of course, we have to keep working at it, even as old as I am, why I still am learning constantly every day. Well, you know, certainly as we see it, what's happening with so many of our industries, and, you know, we find out that General Motors is losing money every quarter, and so is Ford. I mean, how long can these major American corporations continue producing cars in the United States and losing money every quarter? Can you do that indefinitely?
I wouldn't think so, but they've done a real fine job.
Of course, the reason they've been able to stay afloat is because of their finance division, GMAC,
yes.
But they're talking about spinning that off. And, of course, what they're really talking about, although nobody wants to mention this, is simply shifting into bankruptcy here in the United States, getting rid of all their subdivisions, and then moving over to China and producing cars there. And then they can unload all of their pension obligations and all of their health care obligations to the retirees, you know, onto the American taxpayer. And this is what I think that they're really going to do. Have you considered that as a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. I believe it has been their agenda for quite a while. I believe that's their intent. I believe they want to get rid of the pension funds, and as a taxpayer, I don't want to pay it. I don't want to pay somebody else's benefits. But I guess we're going to have to get stuck with it. But absolutely, that's what they want to do. They're going to get rid of their pension funds and move over to China because that's the only way they can be competitive. Now, Ford came out today. You know, they had a third quarter loss of $284 million, and, you know, they're going to be closing a plant. They'll be cutting jobs. And I'm a little surprised that it has taken them this long to stretch it in order not to open factories up in China.
Well, I think they already have the factories there, but I think major base over there.
I can't believe they haven't closed the factories here sooner than what they...
I think it's really only a matter of time. And in fact, I had a gentleman call me the other day. He's worked for General Motors for over 35 years. And, you know, he's scared to death that he's going to lose his pension and maybe even lose his job. And I think there are a lot of good people out there who have been faithful to General Motors. But unfortunately, the unions have made unreasonable demands. I mean, the average salary with benefits is $65 to $68 an hour. $65 to $68. Now, you can hire somebody over in China, you know, for a whole week for that, you know.
A week, how about a year?
Maybe, well, maybe for a month. But anyway, there's just no way that we can compete as long as the globalists are in control of both political parties and are dedicated to transferring the wealth of the American people to other nations. If you doubt that, there's the question, the plan. You need to get hold of a copy of the Earth Charter. Read point number 10. And this document, the new Ten Commandments for America, written by Gorbachev and Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller, point number 10, talks about redistribution of wealth within nations and between nations, and nobody's going to tell you what the real plan is. But if you'd like to get a copy of the Earth Charter, you can pull it off the Internet, or you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you one free of charge. But right now, let's go to Joe's calling from Idaho. Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Oh, good. Listening to your program. I had a question. I had heard, and it was on, I don't know if it was on your program or somebody else's, that there was talk about only certain gold coins being exempt from seizure.
Well, what gold coins were you thinking of? Were you thinking of collectibles or what?
No, bullion. But there wasn't any specification on what was going to be exempt and what wasn't from seizure.
Well, Melody, why don't you cover again what you were telling Ed who'd called earlier, because I think a lot of people would like to know at least what the law is today.
Well, in 1933, it was collectible coins of rare and unusual value. There was really no value stated, and it was special value to collectors of rare and unusual coins. That was stated in the executive order back in 1933. Well, in 1984, the Treasury and the IRS got together and says, well, you know, we're going to define what collectible coins are, and they did so by defining them that they have, they need to be rare and unusual and to have a gold or silver content of 15% or more of the underlying precious metal content. And that would qualify the coin as being a numismatic coin and not a bullion coin.
Well, now, how about some of these commemorative coins? There's an Olympic commemorative coin, that $10 Olympic commemorative coin, and it comes, you know, from the, I guess it's put out by the U.S. Mint, and it comes in a nice little box and folder. Would that be considered a collectible coin and then come under that category?
Well, you know what's sad? There are some commemorative coins that have rare and unusual value and do have an underlying premium of 15%. But I do know of some of these $5 commemoratives and $10 commemoratives that are sold, that I hear about, they're nothing but bullion coins. They sell back at melt value, and they don't exceed the 15% underlying value to qualify them as numismatic coins. What happens is there's commissions that are charged that are so high that that is just stretched, and it seems like it's a valuable coin, but it really isn't. The same way with the Swiss francs. I know there's a dealer in California that sells Swiss francs for, this was before gold rose, for $149. Mine at that time were running around $102. So that's the difference. And
okay, Joe, do you have another question?
Well, my question was, what and where is the source of the information that there might be some sort of seizure, and is the defining line, what you're saying is the defining line is a collectible coin as opposed to a bullion coin, and then what does that do to the value of bullion if you can't sell it back or without getting it seized? You follow what I mean?
Yeah, they would make it illegal to own.
Right, but what happens if you already have them? I mean, how are they going to, or what have you heard, or where is the source of information that is talking about this?
Is it available on your website or anybody else?
You know what, I can't put it on my website. I don't have the paper in front of me as far as the exact information. It's under the IRS and my taxes and so forth.
Right, I understand the difference between the two, one's a bullion, one's an investor claim, but I'm talking about a seizure of gold.
Well, of course, if it comes, they can do whatever they want to. That, of course, has happened in other countries throughout recorded time, and, of course, there are an awful lot of people who have not gone along with that because they feel the government doesn't have the right to do it. However, we're just going to have to wait and see what happens.
Well, the one thing people have to understand is they hold gold bullion when it's illegal to own. What are they going to do with it? How can they use it?
That's a very real problem. They nationalized gold when the communists took over in 1918 in Russia. So, Joe, there are a lot of imponderables about there.
Uh-huh.
We don't have the answers. Wish we had them all.
Okay. Well,
thanks very much for calling. Bye-bye. And we're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Melody Sears-Brom. Well, Melody, we've got just a few minutes more before we have to let you go. Why don't you tell us, do you think that we're going to be seeing more and more people interested in this in the coming weeks, or do you think this thing's just sort of going to keep going on as it has in the past, and the vast majority of the people are simply going to ignore the financial danger, which I think is looming ever larger before us?
All of the above.
All right, fine. That's a good answer.
I think there's been a lot of interest, but we're certainly not in a heated gold market. We're not in a heated demand like I have seen in the past when I saw gold rise from 400 to 454 last year. It was a much more heated, and demand was there was a lot more interest. We saw gold go to 476, and it's been more steady. It doesn't have the move behind it. It doesn't have a momentum behind it. And I sort of prefer the steady business, because I think with buyers out there and when we look at the spot price, I think that's better. I'd much rather see gold go up slowly than gold go up dramatically, because then you'll always have corrections. I like to see when gold creates a steady marker.
And I think really, of course, when we see gold up, it means that people are losing faith in the currency. I think when we see gold go up, it means that people are seeing that the government is simply printing a lot of money with nothing behind it. And, of course, where is the $200 billion going to come from to, rebuild New Orleans and repair the damage? First of all, it's no business of the federal government to do that. I think George Bush, the President Bush, just decided to do that to allay criticism of the way that FEMA acted. After all, it's not his $200 billion he's going to spend. And then, of course, we have, of course, the massive expenditures for the war in Iraq. And what really bothers me is we're really funding our current budget from money that we're borrowing from other countries. We've never been in that position before. And we're running up a larger and larger and larger debt. And there's no incidents in all history where a nation has turned its back on fiscal responsibility where that nation has survived. And I really feel that people need to begin reading history. We have a wonderful little book on the history of money that this is a series of our newsletters. And we'll tell you a little bit later how you can get that. But right now, of course, our guest is Melody Sears-Brom, and we're talking about really what's going on in just a minute. Why, when we have all of our listeners back on board, we'll have Melody go ahead and put out her telephone number just one more time, and then we're going to have to let her go. And Melody, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. My number is...
Oh, hold that just a moment. We want to make sure all the stations are on board. Well, this is Stan, and Melody's going to get her telephone number and her website out one more time. Go ahead.
That is 1-800-375-4188.
One more time.
1-800-375-4188.
And your website?
DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Melody, and of course, she does help Radio Liberty. And, you know, I think that it's important that we just talk from time to time about the things that are happening financially, and, of course, the other things as far as preparation for the difficult times that lie ahead, and the things that you need, whether it would be having a big Berkey on hand so you can have, guaranteed the ability to filter water, potable water, or it would be food supplies, or certainly the medical supplies, certainly the supplies as far as, a home antibiotic program with oil of oregano and the other things that will really help you. And I personally am not in favor of colloidal silver, but I do believe that large doses of vitamin C and D and E, all of which are antioxidants, really can help you as far as fending off an epidemic if one is upon us. you're going to have to depend on your own immunity to protect you. Well, certainly this is the time when we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours every day. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And it's just a compilation of newsletters we put together, but it'll give you an overview not only of the financial implications of our financial system, but the spiritual implications of this, because unless you understand that behind everything that's going on are powerful spiritual forces, you will be incapable of making any sense out of all the paradoxical and contradictory things that are taking place today. So, again, that's The History of Money. It's if you'd like to get that, and then we actually have a DVD called The Coming Financial Crisis, and it's a talk we gave about a year ago. Going into the background, we go into that speech given by Alan Greenspan in 1965, and incidentally, Congressman Ron Paul met Alan Greenspan after a meeting about 2 years ago, and I reconfirmed this story from Ron Paul's press secretary, and Alan Greenspan said, finally, to Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul said to Alan Greenspan, well, I assume then that you would repudiate that essay you wrote back in 1965 on the importance of gold. And Alan Greenspan replied, I recently reread that essay, and I wouldn't change one word of it. And so Alan Greenspan understands we are living, you know, in a balloon, and that balloon is about to pop, and the only thing that's going to give you any security is something of inherent value. And it's certainly not a number, you know, in a computer, which is your bank deposit. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, this whole thing is going to come to a climax in the not-too-distant future. So if you'd like to get either the DVD on the coming financial crisis or our little booklet on the history of money, which is inexpensive, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. We are having some problems as far as our 16 stations we do every afternoon in the Middle West, and if you're in a position to help us so we can maintain that network until we can build it up and get more and more people, 16 stations covers an awful lot of area, and with your help, hopefully we're going to be able to maintain our position there under any circumstances. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, and I'm going to ask our producer to call. The last four numbers will be 3339, rather than the number you're calling. So why don't you try that 3339, and let's just see if we can get our special guest this evening. His name is Mark Sutton, and certainly Mark is a lawyer, practices law and, in the federal courts, but he's written a fascinating book called Walk Through the Wall, America. Walk Through the Wall, America, How We Can Stop Federal Judges from Dictating Our Laws Without Our Approval. And people really have to understand the foundation of our law has always been the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution of the United States stipulated in Article 1, Section 8, what the federal government could do. All the rest of the Constitution is simply the mechanics of how we would divide the authority between the legislative, the judicial, and the executive, and then, of course, between the federal government and the states. And then the rest of it, of course, is to the Bill of Rights is to restrict the power of the federal government. So the federal government can say absolutely nothing about education. The federal government will have no right to come into our homes or to search us or to take away our life or liberty. The federal government will not take away our life, liberty, or property. And the Ninth and Tenth Amendment are simply restrictions on the power of the federal government, basically saying this, that all power is not specifically herein relegated by the states to the Congress are to be relegated to the states and to the people. In other words, if the federal Constitution does not say anything about education, then the federal government cannot do anything about education, and matters dealing with education will be left to the states and the people. And that really was the tradition of our country for at least 150 years. Everybody knew that the Bill of Rights was restriction on the power of the central government. And then suddenly, starting about 50 years or so ago, why, everything got stood on its head. And suddenly the United States Supreme Court started changing the laws of our country. And the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. They were able to twist that around and say there's a wall of separation between church and state, and you're not allowed to have prayer in schools. You're not allowed to have the Ten Commandments in schools. We already had them before, but suddenly everything had been changed. And where did they get the authority to do that? Well, we're going to talk to our special guest this evening, Mark Sutton. Mark, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Well, I guess we're going to have to be going to a first break here, but how is it that you happen to write a book about what's happening in our courts? You know, it doesn't seem that most lawyers are that interested in it, or are they?
Well, I'd say most lawyers are not. I think you're right. The reason I had such an interest in it is because I read cases in law school, especially constitutional cases, that in which judges exceeded their power. And I was very frustrated because it didn't seem like our system had any way to deal with that situation. I later learned I was wrong.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Mark Sutton talking about his book, Walking Through the Wall, America. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly we're talking with Mark Sutton about what's happening in our courts. And we find our Supreme Court justices now, you know, looking at the laws of Europe and the laws of the European Union and and the United Nations Charter and wanting to bring our Constitution into line with that, where would they get the authority to do that? Where does the federal government get the authority to say that, and whether you agree with abortion or not is not the issue, but that there is somewhere in the Constitution the right to privacy? It is not there. What we have is a group of people in black robes who are making law without the consent of the people. If you want to change the Constitution, there's a very easy way to do it. You simply amend it. Well, it's not easy to do, but it can be done, and that's what our founding fathers want. But when we have lawyers making law with no judicial precedent, why, we are on the path to tyranny. Would that be a fair statement, Mark?
Yes, it is. And in fact, the founders thought it was tyranny. Thomas Jefferson said so.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you commented that you when you went to law school, you read a lot of cases on constitutional law. Did they ever teach you in law school the Constitution and how it worked? And did you spend a lot of time studying the makeup of the Constitution, or did you just read constitutional law cases?
Well, we almost exclusively read constitutional law cases. We had to refer to the Constitution in order to find out what the justifications in those cases were for the decisions, but some of the provisions in the Constitution were ignored in law school.
And I really think that's one of the big tragedies. And I can say this as a physician. I think there are a lot of things, a wonderful adventure going to medical school. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, but there are a lot of things I never learned in medical school. I had to get out and practice and learn, and then, well, even since I've left practice, I've continued learning things about medicine. And I think that's probably true with lawyers, too, isn't it? That there are a lot of things that aren't taught in law school that really ought to be taught, like the Constitution, which is the foundation of our law?
Oh, definitely. And I think that, I mean, there's no question that after practicing law for 20 or 30 years, you learn much more law than you would in law school. But also, I think that some things are purposely avoided.
Now, why? What sort of things are you speaking of?
Well, for instance, what I discuss in the book about the impeachment provisions, the checks and balances in the Constitution are extremely important. They're fundamental to the governmental system working. And there was no check on the judiciary talked about in law school. The reason may be that the people who were teaching the classes were lawyers, and there was no reason to, in their minds, to check the interests of lawyers.
Hold that thought for just a minute, because we want to bring our other stations back right online right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Mark Sutton, and we're talking about his book, Walk Through the Wall, America, and of course it goes into the background of the judiciary, the federal judiciary, and Mark was just saying that when he went to law school, nobody ever talked about, you know, restricting the ability of judges to do whatever they wanted to. Maybe that was because the people who were teaching the classes were lawyers, and they didn't see there should be any restriction placed on judges. But Mark does feel that there should be restrictions placed on judges, and certainly if they are not fulfilling their obligation to interpret the Constitution, if they are making up laws on their own, there are certainly provisions within the Constitution to deal with that. So why don't you pick the story up there, Mark?
All right. Basically, the Constitution is structured. The most fundamental doctrine in the Constitution is the separation of powers doctrine. And under that doctrine, only the legislature is allowed to make laws. The reason is that the legislature is subject to election. So if they make laws we do not like, the people do not like, the people can remove them from office during the election process. Also, the legislature is divided up in hundreds and hundreds of people, so that the law is not made by just a few people. With respect to the judiciary, on the other hand, the judiciary's role is to decide cases, controversies, between individuals and organizations, or individuals and individuals. It is not to make law. The separation of powers doctrine, and no one denies that. Under the separation of powers doctrine, judges are not permitted to make law. However, what has happened in the last more than 50 years, about 60 years or 70 years or so, is that the judiciary has developed a theory of interpretation that effectively allows them to make law. And I think the reason that they have gotten by with this is because the only meaningful check in the Constitution that was intended to stop judges from doing that has never been exercised in American history. And that remedy, that check on the judiciary, is impeachment and removal of judges from office. The Federalist Papers, written by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, make that very clear.
All right. Well, now, what about the provision in Article 3, Section 2 that allows the legislature to put a rider onto a bill saying, you know, you judges can't mess with this. You know, we are going to limit your appellate jurisdiction over this issue. Certainly, Tom Jastrow did that with a number of issues that dealt with his state when he was the Senate Majority Leader. What about the Speaker of the Majority Leader? So what about that, you know? Could that be done? Would that be an effective means of reining in the judges?
Well, I think to a limited extent, perhaps. The problem with that remedy, that is stripping jurisdiction from the federal courts, which Congress does have the power to do. I agree it does, and I think it's pretty clear from the Constitution it's been exercised in very small ways before. The problem with that is that throws jurisdiction to the state courts. And the state courts would then be interpreting the federal constitution. We could get 50 different sets of interpretations for the same constitutional provisions. And also, state court judges don't tend to respect the separation of powers any more than federal judges do. Because the method of judging that is taught in law school is the theory of interpretation that I talked about that allows judges to make law.
And, of course, this is such a dangerous situation because what you're talking about is really rule by men rather than rule by law. And then, of course, we're always told we're a nation of law, but the law is what the judge says. And if the judge says that black is white, it becomes black, you know, even though there's no justification for it. In fact, you know, I certainly, as far as this wall of separation for church of state is, you know, nobody ever tells the American people that every time the Supreme Court meets, why the crier comes in to open the session saying, God save the United States and this honorable court. Well, how could the judges possibly then, since by tradition their sessions start by mention of God, how could they possibly decree that you couldn't mention God in school? I just don't understand how you could possibly, you know, stretch the anything in the Constitution to justify taking God out of school unless that was the real agenda. It was to change the religious foundation of this country.
Well, I think that is a subliminal motivation by the judges. The thing that has given them the so-called authority to do this was a decision in 1947 called Everson versus Ewing Board of Education. That's when the separation of church and state was injected into the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment that you quoted earlier, Dr. Stand, that was done unilaterally by the U.S. Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court did that, in the analysis of the Supreme Court completely ignored the annals of Congress concerning the meaning of the Establishment Clause. And the Establishment Clause does not have the breadth of the separation of church and state. The separation of church and state in its logical application, in its strictest application, is so broad that it would prohibit police and fire protection for people in churches and religious schools. That is scary. That is something that should scare every American. But that is what the separation of church and state is capable of doing. So what the judges were doing when they created separation of church and state was basically giving them the power to pick and choose what they want to prohibit and to allow what they want to allow.
And, Chris, the frightening thing is that we now have all we need is five people on the Supreme Court to totally change the laws of our land and totally change the moral fabric of our society, and that's exactly what they've done. Since 1962, when they first came along and began to take God and prayer out of our schools, do you think that they realized what they were doing when they destroyed the religious foundation of this country?
Oh, I think so. I think they knew exactly what they were doing. I mean, these judges were brilliant people. What they did in creating separation of church and state in the Ewing case in 47 would not pass muster on a law school exam. I mean, it would not give a passing grade. The analysis that was done in that case, they not only ignored the annals of Congress, but they also ignored a lot of other legal principles that are fundamental principles for interpreting the Constitution. But they knew what they were doing because they that was giving them power, and as typical of people in governmental positions, is they believe that their views are the correct views, and so if they're exercising power that they shouldn't be exercising, they believe that it's acceptable because they're good people, and that's a form of tyranny. Almost every dictator that has ever lived thought that he was doing a good thing.
And I think what the dangerous precept here was that it totally transformed the foundation of our country. Our founding country was founded on the precept that our freedom comes from God. And, of course, it's laid out very clearly in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, where it talks about, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. And that is what our country is all about. We have laws, we have a constitution. The structure of our government was to guarantee our God-given rights. And suddenly you had a group of lawyers who didn't believe in God, who were going to really say that we couldn't have God as the foundation for a society, and then we would replace God with government. Anybody ever explain that concept to the members of the bar?
Well, nobody explains that. I think that's implicit in the way law is taught these days in most places, in most law schools. And this idea came out in the recent Ten Commandments decision, Mercury County versus ACLU. In that decision, the Ten Commandments display was justified by the state of Kentucky based upon the fact that the Declaration of Independence referred to the very language you talked about, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that the Ten Commandments, that was a reflection of the concepts of the Ten Commandments concerning what God has declared mankind's laws should be governed by. What the court said in that case was one of the other statements that you quoted, that government's power is derived from the consent of the governed. And the court said a reasonable observer would be perplexed if they were trying to figure out a link between the Ten Commandments and the Declaration of Independence. But the court completely ignored. They quoted the language about the government receiving its power from the consent of the governed, but they completely ignored the language in the Declaration of Independence, which says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. So what the Declaration of Independence was clearly saying was that the rights flow from God to the governed to the government, not just from the governed to the government. The judges are saying.
Of course, I know you're well acquainted with Judge Roy Moore and his stand for the Ten Commandments and the fact that he was, of course, removed from his position of Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. But I subscribe to his magazines put out by the American Humanist Society, who, of course, would be totally against Judge Roy Moore and everything he stands for. But there was a fascinating article there where they were actually talking about what had happened to Judge Moore in the recent poll of the American people, and over 70% of them thought that Judge Roy Moore was right and that the courts that had taken away his position were wrong. And they just couldn't understand how the American people should be so narrow and parochial and a sort of limited view that they would think that the courts could possibly be wrong. And, of course, I was sitting there just sort of cheering as I read that, thinking, the opinions of the American people are so much smarter than these learned men who have a different agenda and who hate the God of the Bible. We're going to be back here in just a few moments with our special guest, Mark Sutton, and we're going to welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And Mark has written a very provocative book, a very courageous book, because he suggested what nobody else wants to suggest. And that is, when judges violate their oath of office, there's one way to deal with it. And we should impeach them, a Supreme Court justice, or any other justice who violates his oath is unfit to serve in office. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Mark Sutton. And Mark, certainly there are a number of books been written recently about this concept of usurpation of power by our courts, and certainly Phyllis Schlafly is a personal friend, and we've had her on as a number of times with her book, The Supremacist, but she didn't really want to go here. I don't think most people want to take that final step, which we may very well have to, and that is to say, we're going to have to impeach judges who violate their oath of office. Why won't most people go to that position?
Well, there are a few reasons, I think. One is I think that most people haven't done the research to find out that, in fact, that is what is intended by the Constitution. If you read the language of the Constitution itself, it's not that clear. And that's why I thought there was nothing that could be done except to try to motivate judges to voluntarily stay within their power. When I did the research, I found that that is quite wrong, and that Professor Raoul Berger at Harvard Law School did extensive research on this during the Watergate era and concluded that in the English law system, from which that language was derived, that is, the language in the Constitution about impeachment, that impeaching judges for making unconstitutional decisions, that is, for exceeding their power, was the appropriate remedy. Also, I think that people tend to think that this is not a politically feasible idea. I disagree, because all it would take is a national debate on this issue, and a lot of judges would be deterred from this kind of behavior. Also, all it takes in the House of Representatives is a vote of the members of the House by a majority vote, a simple majority, to impeach a judge. That is like an indictment. It doesn't mean that the judge is removed from office. There has to be a trial in the Senate and then a two-thirds vote in the Senate. And that two-thirds vote seems daunting, especially today and especially in recent times. But I think that if a judge was impeached and tried in the Senate for exceeding his or her power, I think that that would send shockwaves to the judiciary. And in fact, the judiciary was afraid of that after the November 2004 elections, because the report of the Supreme Court that came out on January 1st of this year addressed the issue of impeaching judges and said that judges should never be impeached for their judicial decisions.
And I think that, of course, it's exactly the opposite is the case, and I think there was very good reason to think about impeaching the judges for their decision in 2004.
Correct, and the reasoning given in that report, in that Supreme Court report, is simply wrong. The reasoning given was twofold. One is that the Supreme Court cited what they call political precedent concerning a judge named Samuel Chase in the early 1800s that was not impeached. He was impeached, but he was not removed from office during Thomas Jefferson's presidential administration. The problem with that view, they say in that report that's a basis for not impeaching judges, but in fact, that judge, that particular Supreme Court justice, was impeached, but he was just not removed. Secondly, the historians say that the reason that he was not removed was not because that he wouldn't have been removed otherwise, but because the person who led the impeachment trial in the Senate offended other senators so much that they voted against it. So it wasn't because it was improper under the Constitution. It was because of political considerations. The other reason is that the Federalist Papers make it very clear. Alexander Hamilton called impeachment a complete security against judicial lawmaking, against
hold
judges.
Hold that thought right there, Mark. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mark is simply talking about the history of this concept of impeachment. Supreme Court justice has ever been impeached. They tried. Was that back in the time of Thomas Jefferson?
Yes, it was. It was Samuel Chase, Justice Samuel Chase. Now they weren't trying to impeach him because he exceeded his power, but because he prejudged cases. He was actually acting as an advocate for one side against his political opponents in court.
Right. And of course, that would be totally unjust. But then we may even consider that could be what happened in 2004. When a Republican, Republicans, how they could possibly justify interfering in the vote counting or the vote determination by a state. You know, I certainly did not support Al Gore, but I don't think the federal government has the right to interfere with the counting of votes in a state and override the decision of the state Supreme Court, even though the state Supreme Court was predominantly Democratic and they would have given the election to Al Gore. I don't think the federal government had any right to intervene. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on that was actually what the Constitution says is that the Florida legislature was supposed to make that decision,
right,
not the Florida courts. And the Florida courts were actually going to call for a recount of the vote of all across the state. That's where they were going. That was the decision that was reversed. And when the special interest groups went in and counted the votes across the state afterwards, it turned out that Bush would have won anyway. But the Florida legislature was the one that was supposed to make that decision. The Florida courts were not, and neither was the Supreme Court, frankly, the U.S. Supreme Court. But it was supposed to be the Florida legislature, and then if it went beyond the Florida legislature, it was supposed to go into U.S. House of Representatives. It wasn't supposed to be a decision made by the courts, according to the Constitution, in my view.
And I think that's absolutely right. And what we've done is basically what Thomas Jefferson feared so very much. In fact, he wrote, "You know, it has long been my opinion, and I've never shrunk from its expression, that the germ of dissolution of our federal government is in the constitution of our federal judiciary, an irresponsible body, for impeachment is scarcely a scarecrow, working like gravity by night and by day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisdiction, until all shall be usurped from the states, and the government of all be consolidated into one." And certainly Thomas Jefferson already feared that we would have a government created that would be as venal and intolerant as the British government, and he recognized the danger of the Supreme Court. The tragedy is most people today have been so cowed that they think whatever the court says is the law of the land, but it really isn't. Isn't the law still the Constitution?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And in fact, the Supreme Court is subject to the Constitution. That's an authority over the Supreme Court. Theoretically, practically, in practical effect today, the Supreme Court's decisions are deemed to be constitutional law, unfortunately. But that can be changed. That can be changed if the appropriate checks in the U.S. Constitution are exercised for once in our nation's history.
Well, certainly it would appear to me that this is not being taught in law school. The attorneys are being taught that the judge determines the law. But the law was laid out in the Constitution. It cannot be changed simply by judicial edict. And does anybody ever, mention or in law school the fact that there are means of changing the law by amendment rather than by just judicial edict? Is anybody concerned about the power that the judges have taken unto themselves to transform our society from a Christian society into a secular society into the pagan society it's becoming?
Not in my experience. Not in my law school experience, and I think that's probably true of most law schools across the country. The law professors don't teach those issues. They're focused on what the courts are saying at a given point in time, and that is what they teach as law.
But of course, the shorts men, of course, can always change their minds. And if you have one group of course wants to, give all power to the federal government and destroy the system of checks and balances, why, they can do that. In fact, this is exactly what they've done. Today, most of what the federal government is doing is totally unconstitutional, and yet there is no outcry from anybody. We see massive expenditures for a federal control of education, and then we begin to see the end result of that, and the reading scores are going down, at least here in California. And of course, we got 30% of the students, who are reading at the level that they should, in the fourth grade, and about 28% reading at their level they should be in the eighth grade. And the federal government's in charge. Is that a very good commentary on what the federal government's doing?
It sure isn't, and there are many other areas where the same kinds of results occur.
And I think it's about time people begin to understand that there's no problem facing America today, that a new series of federal laws, government interference, won't, of course, complicate matters. We only have to look and see what happened to Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, to verify that. We'll be back in just a moment. With Mark Sutton, we'll welcome your calls. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, Mark Sutton, his book, Walk Through the Wall, America. Mark, what sort of response are you getting? Because you must be doing other radio programs, talking to other people about this idea that we have an obligation to impeach Supreme Court justices who refuse to interpret the law according to the Constitution and rather insert their own opinions.
Well, I'm getting a great response with people I talk to and people that call in, also the radio talk show hosts that I've been on. I've been on many of them. I don't know that I'm getting a great response yet on purchases of the book. Before I started getting on the radio, I still don't know what those sales were. You can get the book at there's a phone number for the book at my website, www.judicialimpeachment.com, where you can get the book if you wish. But I think it's a reflection of our education system to some extent. I think that people feel like they're powerless concerning the government, and I want to dispel that idea. We are not powerless, even though many of the protections of the Constitution have been removed. Not all of them have been removed, and we should fight. We should fight for our rights. Many people have died for what we believe in, and we shouldn't stand by and let this happen.
Well, I certainly agree with what you're saying, and I think that it is an idea that time has come. Well, let's go to Randall, who's calling us from Oklahoma. Randall, is that you?
Yes. Good evening, Dr. Stan.
How are you doing tonight, Randall?
Doing good, sir. Doing good. I have just two brief questions I'd like to ask, won't take up much time, and then maybe I can go ahead and hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Well, why don't you ask one question, and then we'll get that answered, and then we'll get to the second question. What's your first question?
At what point in history, or which U.S. president was in office when the government changed from being a true democracy to a constitutional republic?
When were we ever a true democracy?
Well, now, that's what I remember learning about in school.
Well, I don't
think been quite a while ago.
Well, you know, if you read the Constitution, you will never see the mention of the word democracy. If you read the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, or even the Federalist Papers, you won't see any mention of democracy other than saying, oh, we don't want a democracy. So you probably got the same sort of education that I got, telling us America's a democracy. It was never a democracy. It was always a constitutional republic. Every one of our states is to be a republic according to the Constitution and according to the Constitution of the states. We'll be back in just a moment here with Randall. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Mark Sutton, and we're talking about his book, Walk Through the Wall. Mark, would you like to tell our listeners once again how they could get copies of your book if they'd like to?
Well, you can get the book if you call 1-866-909-BOOK. That's 888, I'm sorry, that's 866, not 888, 866-909-2665.
2665, or that's book, okay?
Yes, or you can go to my website, www.judicialimpeachment.com, and that same phone number is there.
All right, fine. Well, we have Randall calling from Oklahoma, and Randall was saying, when did we stop being a democracy and become a constitutional republic, and how would you respond to Randall?
Well, I agree that we never were a pure democracy. A pure democracy would be the people being able to vote on every issue, and there being no basic constitutional rights to protect people from a tyranny of the majority. We've always been a constitutional republic. Some of those protections that we had, though, in our Constitution have been eroded since they were initially created.
And so, Randall, I hope that answers your question. If you went to school and they taught you the democracy, they were lying to you, just like they lied to me. And I was 33 years old. I had a Phi Beta Kappa Chi. I graduated with honors, a minor in history from the University of California. And I didn't know the difference between a republic and a democracy.
Yes, I understand now, Dr. Stan. My other question regards the Ten Commandments appeal in Montgomery, Alabama.
All right, what about it?
The ruling on that, I'm of the opinion that the judges that ruled on that swore their oath on the Bible, and it wasn't on the Koran.
What you're trying to do is be logical, you know. And of course, Mark Rogers saying, how could these judges want to take the, you know, Ten Commandments out of political places and, you know, remove Bible reading from our schools when they have to swear an oath on the Bible?
Yeah,
isn't there some inconsistency there?
Yeah, there is. And they say, so help me God, when they give their oath of office. There are many inconsistencies with the views of the Supreme Court and our nation's traditions that have been in effect since the beginning of the country.
In fact, if you read the Constitution of every single state in the Union today, all 50 of them, they all talk about they derive their authority from God. So how can the Supreme Court do what it's done? Very simply, because there are five people there who have a different opinion, who have a different worldview, who would destroy the religious foundation of this country. When you understand that, everything makes sense.
Yes. Incidentally, if you would like to look back at this particular issue of USA Today, the date was Thursday, August the 21st, 2003, and the picture on the front page there shows police officers dragging Christians through the streets, and it's just pretty disgusting to look at. So I wish you gentlemen a pleasant evening. Thanks for answering my question.
God bless. Thanks so very much.
Dr. Stan, yes. I'd like to say that in one of the Ten Commandments cases, the Van Orden v. Perry case that came out earlier this year, a plurality of four justices talked about the many traditions acknowledging God in our government. When they ruled that the Ten Commandments display in the Texas case was constitutional, so there is some glimmer of hope there.
All right. Well, let's go to Craig calling from Detroit here. And hi, Craig. How you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Comment. Can I be blunt? Okay. I'm a black man in America. You know, black people are basically somewhat disenfranchising this government. Now, black people have an inherent distrust of government because of what they've been through. You know what I mean, right?
Right.
Okay, now, what I want to know is what's going on with the majority. When I was younger, I used to sit back and kind of depend on the majority to make good decisions and vote for good people. And, you know, because, like I say, most black people do feel somewhat disenfranchised, but what I think is going on with the majority is that they're sitting on their thumbs and allowing this Republican doctrine, who actually appeal to me to what I consider is a racist doctrine.
Well, now, what doctrine are you speaking of? Are you saying Republican doctrine? Are you saying the Republican Party? Are you speaking of the concept that we have a Republican form of government? In other words, by republic, do you limit the power of the central authority over the lives of the people?
Well, somewhat. What I see is, okay, they appeal to anti-affirmative action, anti-welfare, anti-tax, where we become a government who no longer takes care of its own.
I see. Do you think it's the function of government then to take care of people from the cradle?
Well, you know what? From a point of view of a black person, you have to, because you're the first fired and last hired, you have to kind of depend on the government a little bit.
Well, no, you
kind
have
of,
to.
All
right, let's get Mark's opinion. Craig is saying we've got to depend upon the government to look after the black people, because after all, if the government isn't going to look after the black people, who's going to look after them?
Exactly.
Let's get Mark's comment, and then, of course, I'd like to give you my answer then.
Yes, well, you know, as far as, you know, your suspicion or your distrust of the government, I think that's very consistent with what the founders of this country also had, a distrust of governmental power.
Exactly, and that's where it should still be. I can say white people, but, you know, actually, that's the way it is. I mean, if you be honest,
let Mark go ahead.
Let me finish about what I was going to say about what I think your distrust of the government is a healthy mistrust. And it is, in fact, something that the founders of the country had in common with you. And when they created the government, They what we mean by a Republican government is not the Republican Party.
Well,
what we mean by the Republican government is a government that has constitutional protections for everybody, not just the people in the majority, but everybody is protected by certain constitutional protections, and also protected by doctrines like the separation of powers that keeps the power divided among many people. That's
right.
What a Republican form of government is. That's what we mean by that.
Right.
So
how was it the luck of the draw that most of the time the Republicans are picking the Supreme Court, because they're just going backwards and backwards and backwards?
Well, I think, Craig, if you listen to our program regularly, you realize
that
same people control both political parties. And the thing is, if you want somebody to look after you, how is it that any different than slavery? I mean, certainly under slavery, the master looked after the people who were under him.
Exactly.
Please, Craig, let me finish.
Okay, go ahead.
America was different. They limited the power of the federal government. Because the people who created this country realized you couldn't trust people with power. It would always be misused, whether it was the slave master or whether it was the politicians in Washington, D.C., and as unjust as this society might be, if people were free, you have the ability to get ahead or to fail. You have the ability to work for who you want to. You have the ability to move wherever you want to. But when government regulates everything, you lose your freedom. And any government that can provide whatever you need has got to be able to take whatever you have. And every government that can provide for you from the cradle of the grave got to be able to control you from the cradle of the grave. And that is the direction we're heading.
Now, Dr. Stan, that is such a good viewpoint. I mean, that is so, but you see how we are caught, and it's a very important issue to blacks. We are caught in really a catch-22. We almost need taken care of because, like I said, we are basically a disenfranchised people, and then we don't want the government to have power over us, but then again, without that help from the government, you know, somebody's got to be at the bottom in this, because the country has actually gone super capitalism, and somebody's got to be at the bottom.
Well, the
so,
thing is,
you know, what are you going to do? Either you get help from the government, or either you starve, or, it's really a bad catch-22 for blacks.
And either that, you're going to have to stand on your own feet, Craig, and I realize that there are a lot of people who want to look to the government, but you can't have it both ways.
You can't have a government
that's going to give you freedom and look after you, too.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And the freedom that we have is really not freedom.
And we're losing it, and we're losing it rapidly. And I can share your concern.
We should be together on this.
We are in many ways. You just keep right on listening. Thanks so much for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Good night. And do you have anything else you'd like to say in addition?
Okay, well, I just want to say one thing. How can DTE, I know a girl down the street, her husband, they broke up. She's got three kids. She can't pay the gas bill. They cut her gas and lights off. How can that happen? And
believe me, Craig,
I just don't, you know.
Craig, it's going to get a lot worse before.
Yeah, I know. Older people are going to freeze to death this year.
I'm afraid. Back tonight. What are your thoughts on that? What Craig is saying is a lot of people feel that, you know, they're not getting a fair shake in our society, that it's an unjust society, and that we need the government to help people, the federal government. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a place for charity, and I believe, of course, it should be at the local level. Not even at the state level, but, you know, Craig wants to look to the federal government to solve the problem. Do you think the federal government really cares about the people and really going to solve their problem? Or is it going to make things a lot worse?
No, I don't. And in fact, there is no example in human history of a central government like the U.S. federal government providing for our people in a society and not having a lot of poor people in that society. And I think that the fact that there is no historical precedent for that is an indication that that kind of system will not work. As you say, you can't have provision from government and not have control of your life by government. And so it is a catch-22 situation, as Craig says. And I think that what we have to do is in fact have people on a local level. And I think that all of us, that I think what Craig says is legitimate. I think that in the sense that, not in the sense of asking the government to do it, but in the sense that we should be doing it in churches and local organizations, helping people who are struggling.
And I think that, there is a place for local government to help people. In other words, when I was growing up and when I first went into medicine, every county had a county hospital. And, you know, that was where you went if you didn't have any money. And the doctors went there out of the goodness of their heart and gave their time, and not all doctors, but the majority of the better doctors, because they really were concerned. And we had a poorhouse. In other words, we had places that people could go, and they would have a place to sleep, and they would have, you know, food, and we had wards for people who were incapacitated rather than nursing homes. There were wards there, and there were two or three nurses' aides there that looked after those older people as long as they needed to, and turned them and fed them. But we did this locally without money from the government. Once the federal government got into this, why, things went from bad to worse. That's exactly where we are today. And Craig's worried about the woman up the street. Maybe she's going to, you know, they're going to turn off her electricity and turn off her gas. Well, there should be local provisions to help. First of all, as you say, the family, and then the church, but then the local community should have a place for her and her family to go. But now we've removed all sense of responsibility from people and from churches and from local
from
communities.
Neighbors.
And, you know, and of course, then there's nothing for these people.
Yes, and I think that we have to get the concept of neighborhood and of loving our neighbors back into America.
Right. Either we have less government and more individual morality and responsibility, or we have a tyrannical government, and everybody, of course, is crushed under the boot heel.
And Dr. Stan, I think the foster care system is another example of that.
Sure.
We have a foster care system that is either controlled centrally by a state government that is far removed from the children that are being helped, that are supposedly being helped, and a federal government. And the foster care system is just full of problems. I mean, these children are bounced around from one home to another, and it's an unmanageable problem, and they keep trying to fix it through government programs and laws. It's not working. What worked in the past was when local people took care of the people in their community. And that is the only way it's going to work, because those are the only people that see those people.
And the federal
government doesn't see them.
And all we need to do is see what the federal government has done for the black people. Oh, we've given them freedom. No, we haven't. We've destroyed the very integrity of the black family. At one time, the black family was a strong, integral part of our society. And today, 75% of black children are born out of wedlock, and the welfare state has destroyed the integrity of the black family. And we could spend a whole evening about the AIDS epidemic and how this epidemic has a predilection for blacks. Do you think that happened just by accident? I mean, when people say, we love you, we want to help you, but do they really, or simply they say what you want to hear? And I think I agree with you totally, Mark. We've got to get back to the local community. We've got to get back to moral people. But then we've removed morality from our schools. We've removed a sense of responsibility from the individuals. And people looked to government and said, we just want you to help us. Well, that's a return to slavery. Let's go to Roger, who's calling. We've been waiting patiently on the line from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Yeah, thanks, Jensen. I think you're overdue from a visit from Star Park, where the last caller could broach some of the same questions. I wanted to ask a number of things you talked about. I think there's a real shortage of cases or even noise towards going after one of the biggest central anti-constitutional heresies, that being the federal supreme's invention of the incorporation doctrine out of the 14th Amendment, where everything's a business of the federal government. And then some people say there's even earlier precedents. That would have been the...
Fine, now, do you have a question?
Yeah, well, if you guys could speak to that.
All right, fine, the incorporation document. Doctrine.
Right. Well, the incorporation doctrine is basically that the concept is that the Liberty Due Process Clause, the Liberty portion of the Due Process Clause, which says that no state shall deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law, incorporated many of the provisions of the Bill of Rights against the states to restrict the states.
But that was not what the people who voted for the 14th Amendment anticipated at all or meant.
No, they did not. And specifically with respect to the religion clauses, including the Establishment Clause, the Congress rejected application of that to the states after the 14th Amendment was ratified twice before the Supreme Court did it by judicial edict.
And that is really what's so frightening, Roger, is that we have people who are making laws on the Supreme Court because they want to change our society. And since they will not adhere to what's right, and they really do not care at all what the public wants, then, of course, the only thing we can do is impeachment. And I think it's about time that we consider that. I think Mark has been very courageous to suggest that in his book, and I recommend the book to you. Thanks so much for calling, Roger. Bye-bye. Okay, and certainly we've got time for one more call. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 4464-8295. Our guest, Mark Sutton, his book, Walk Through the Wall, America. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Mark Sutton. Mark, what does walk through the wall refer to?
Okay, walk through the wall refers to the wall of separation between church and state. That wall is an illusion, and therefore we should walk through it. And the way we should walk through it is by impeaching and removing judges who apply that doctrine and expand that doctrine, because they are applying something that is not in the Constitution. That's what it is a reference to. Specifically, more generally, it's a reference to a wall of judge-made laws that we should walk through because they are illusions. They are not in the Constitution, and we should remove those judges from office who enforce these new man-made laws that are not in our Constitution.
Amen. Well, let's go to Jack calling from Michigan. Hi, Jack. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I wanted to ask, 1933, when the gold standard was suspended, according to the Constitution, I would think that gold and silver as legal tender money would be the lifeblood of the Republic, and if that was terminated, then the Republic ceased to exist in this thing called democracy or private corporate fascism under commercial law, which is represented in the military martial rule tribunals with the gold fringe flag as admiralty equity.
Okay, thank you, Jack. And so Jack wants to, of course, get off onto a really sort of a entirely different subject this whole idea of our admiralty courts. But really we're talking this evening about the Supreme Court, and we're talking about this whole effort to actually limit the power of our judges and put them on notice. So, you know, do you think we're ever going to get this accomplished? Or if we do not get this accomplished, can we survive as a free society?
Well, I frankly think that the judiciary is the biggest threat to our Republican form of government in the United States today. I mean, I think it's a bigger threat than terrorism. It's not a bigger security threat, but I think it's a bigger threat in terms of taking away the rights of the American people to govern themselves. And I think that we must think about it, and not only think about it, but debate it and make it a reality in our governmental system so there is a check on the judiciary. Right now, there is no effective check on the judiciary.
Well, we're going to have to let you go, but I certainly agree with you, and I think that it's an idea. Time has come, and I congratulate you for having the courage to write the book, and we're going to have you on our other programs, because I want our other listeners to hear what you have to say about the importance of walking through the wall, doing away with the wall of church and state, and, of course, letting judges know that if they do not abide by their oath, they'll be impeached. Good night. God bless you, Mark.
Good night. Thank you very much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Mark Skousen, Mark Sutton, and, of course, we've been talking about his book, Walk Through the Wall, America. And the fact that there really are problems in our society because we have judges who do not believe in our Constitution. And we have judges in the Supreme Court who hate God. They would convert us from a Christian nation to a secular nation to where we are today, and that is a pagan nation. These things did not happen by accident. They happened by intent. And it's about time the American people got educated. And this is why I do what I do 5 hours a day, trying to educate the people that we are not a democracy, we are a republic. And you can read the Bill of Rights, and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Federalist Papers, and you'll never see mention of the word democracy other than to say we don't want a democracy. We want a republic, for as James Madison said, democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention, are incompatible with the rights of private property and personal liberty, and are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. That comes from the 10th of the Federalist Papers, but they never teach that in school. Why? Because democracy leads to dictatorship. Plato wrote that 2,400 years ago. Democracy always ends with despotism. And there are people who want a despotism in America. It's time people got educated. If you'll keep listening to Radio Liberty and help us as we reach out across America, join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us. We 5 hours a day by radio, 5 hours a day on the Internet, and you can listen to our Internet programs at www.radioliberty.com, 4 hours a day on shortwave. And incidentally, our shortwave frequencies change on the 30th of October, and we will be remaining on one evening frequency. That's East Coast time, 11 to 1, at West Coast time, 8 to 1, at 5.835. But the other frequency for both afternoon and evening programs changes to 7.490. That's 7.490 megahertz if you listen to Radio Liberty on the shortwave. And then we want to remind you we are having a all-day seminar in Santa Cruz, Monterey Bay region on November 19th. We hope that many of you will want to come. And if you're going to come, of course, we need to know. You'll have to give us a call ahead of time at 1-800-544-8927 because we're serving lunch. We need to know how many can be there. Again, that's all-day seminar on the 19th of November. And then, of course, we ask you to certainly tell others about our program and encourage them to listen. And if you're listening to our program on the Here's Help Radio Network, remember we do a program there in the central part of the country, central time, from 12:30 to 1 every Saturday. That's 12:30 to 1 on the Here's Help Radio Network. And encourage others to listen to our programs in the afternoons where this program will be rebroadcast. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival because we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers because we're asked to do that. But lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.